everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, a special in-depth look at the pain, profit, and politics of AIDS. During this segment of our program, we're going to be speaking with John Lorenson. John is a retired market research analyst, author, gay liberationist, an activist, and currently the founder and head of Pagan Press, which publishes books that reach the gay community. Earlier, John wrote for the New York Native, where he argued against the science behind HIV and AIDS and raised legitimate questions concerning the safety of the primary drug used for a period of time at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic called AZT. More recently, he is best known for his theoretical book, The Man Who Wrote Frankenstein, which explores whether the real author of the novel by that name was written by Percy Shelley and not his wife. John's website is paganpress.com, and he has a large collection of articles and essays on gays, gay liberation, and other subjects. Nice to have you with us today, John.
Well, it's good to hear from you again.
John, the reason for this series is because historically the information disseminated on AIDS by the scientific community, by physicians, by people within the gay community, including the gay activists, by the foundations, of which there were 75,000 at its highest point, its pinnacle, by virtually all the major governmental agencies, the National Cancer Institute, the National Institutes of Health, have all stated the following, that HIV is caused by a single retrovirus, HIV. There is no need for any other contributing cofactors, and that the treatment should be aggressive and quick to get started in order to prolong a person's life. Lifespans have been determined to be very short to very long, and they've given different rationalizations. There have been hundreds of thousands of studies and articles published about AIDS. Therefore, when just a handful of journalists, myself being the first, a handful of scientists, Dr. Carrie Mullis and Dr. Peter Duesberg at the beginning, and a few others, just a handful of gay activists, yourself included, and Charles Ortlieb, Benita Ostrom of the New York Native, began to ask some just basic questions. And these were legitimate questions that in any other area of science or medicine or public health would be either welcomed or at least accepted as a part of the dialogue. Was this really an infectious disease? Was everyone on the planet equally susceptible? Was this the best form of treatment? Was this an accurate gold standard HIV antibody test? Was it really accurate? Or was there a possibility that you may have another condition and therefore end up with a HIV positive diagnosis when you really didn't have HIV, you had something else? And were any of the deaths early on really coming from the treatment instead of the virus? Now, those are not unreasonable questions. And yet, anyone offering any of these questions was considered almost heretical. And not only were these questions rejected, but then those who were asking the questions were personally attacked, their character, their integrity, their sense of honesty and fairness. In fact, if you questioned this, you were considered homophobic. You were called an AIDS denialist. No one that I knew, no journalist, no scientist, no physician, no activist, no researcher, was in denial of AIDS, defining illnesses, but we had legitimate questions, as we had had before, long before this, when the war against cancer and using only chemotherapy and radiation, and the war against mental illness and the war against other conditions had failed miserably. So we felt that it was legitimate to ask this. That is where we begin your journey. When did you realize that members, not all by any means, but some members of the gay community, were simply wrong about their understanding of AIDS, and how did this come about?
Well, I'd put it a bit differently. I would say the main mistake of the so-called gay community was being gullible, which is to say they believed what was said by public health officials and by people representing the AIDS industry. But I became involved in 1983 with Hank Wilson in San Francisco over trying to warn gay men about the danger of poppers. Poppers are volatile nitrites. It was the premier recreational drug, and we wrote a number of articles in the paper. We published a pamphlet and in 1986 a book called Death Rush, Poppers, and AIDS. And this led me to believe that basically the official viewpoint was just wrong, and eventually that they were liars. But my first letter criticizing the official AIDS thing was in 1984. That was in a gay paper. 1985 was my first major AIDS article published in the Philadelphia Gay News. And I showed that the CDC basically lied about their statistics, trying to make it look as though AIDS were an infectious disease instead of something that was very likely caused by toxins like poppers.
Okay, please continue.
Well, it's a long story. I mean, I became involved with the New York Native, and I wrote for them for an entire decade. I didn't agree with everything the New York Native published, but at least they believed in free speech, and they published me. And I, you know, part of the history of my struggle is in my book, The AIDS War, which was published in 1993, sorry. It's still in print, and it's not the absolute latest on the scientific thing, but it gives a good history of all of the different struggles that took place.
Could you highlight some of those now for us? Because many of the listeners to this program, which is worldwide, are not familiar, except for the official position. We have only heard one side of this discussion. We've only heard from one group of individuals, the official pro-AIDS establishment, meaning that whatever they tell us has to be true, and there has been no forum, no open debate by those who hold a contrary point of view about how it should be tested, how it should be treated. So would you give us the benefit of highlighting some of the major struggles, some of the major points, some of the fallacies you found, some of the propaganda being perpetrated within the gay community, and also something is rarely, if never, discussed in the media, and that is the gay-on-gay attacks. Because I've spoken with multiple gay journalists who said they were attacked by other gays because they wouldn't get on board the HIV kills everyone and the drugs or the approach bandwagon. So
okay,
share
that,
some of your history.
Into a rather complex area. I don't think there is such a thing as a gay community. I think it's phony. And as far as the so-called gay leaders are, I don't recognize the idea of a gay leader. People were promoted as gay leaders. Some of them were phonies, some of them were stupid and deluded, and some of them were bribed and so on. But my own position at AIDS, though, to put it in a nutshell, is that I believe that AIDS is not a coherent disease entity. I think it's a phony construct where a lot of different illnesses are put under the umbrella concept of AIDS. I think that different people with AIDS diagnoses are sick in different ways, and they're sick for different reasons. For example, to take the absolute simplest thing of all, why are heroin users getting pneumonia, which is called AIDS, if they are positive on the HIV test? And heroin users have been studied for 100 years. We know a lot about them. And typically, heroin users get pneumonia, which kills them. And the pneumonia they get now is the same as it was 100 years ago. There's no clinical difference. They get pneumonia for two reasons. Heroin wrecks the health in general, and heroin, as an opiate, suppresses lung function, which is why codeine, for example, used to be used in cough syrups. Between suppressing lung function and wrecking the health, it's not surprising that heroin users get pneumonia. But in New York City, the health commissioner admitted to me that if they have a heroin user with pneumonia, they give them an HIV antibody test, which is totally phony. And if it's positive, they say they have AIDS. If it's negative, they say they have, heroin pneumonia. But the clinical profiles are identical. That's to say, gay men is a lot more complicated, why they get sick in maybe three dozen different ways. It would be a matter of psychological factors, self-hatred, low self-esteem, the fact that, we live in a culture which hates us, as well as all sorts of toxins, recreational drugs, not to mention cigarettes and alcohol and all of the rest of it. I don't know if I've gone off the track, but...
No, you're giving us some insights. What we really need from you is the 40-year history of your commitment to finding the truth and not settling for lies, half-truths, distortions, or propaganda. We need whatever insight you're willing to share with us of what you discovered.
Well, you mentioned attacks. I can discuss those. Hank Wilson and I both received death threats for criticizing paupers. And the people who called up didn't say, hello, I represent the paupers industry, but they came immediately after we took stands. The one that I got was a woman, and she very professionally said, don't be surprised if you don't wake up in the morning. Click. And this was after the first time I spoke out publicly against paupers. And I had to decide whether to risk my life continuing to criticize paupers or to stop it. And, I continued to criticize paupers, and I'm still here. But attacks from gay men, certainly there are gay men that I would call traitors, like Martin Delaney of Project Inform, the late Martin Delaney, attacked, me and Celia Farber and other people viciously and tried to make our editors, cease to publish us. And Martin Delaney made a small fortune in various ways from the AIDS industry. So he was not alone. There were a lot of gay men or people posing as gay men who got lots of money by being on the side of AIDS orthodoxy. But I don't... it's tricky. A lot of gay men were deluded, and I think they were deluded partly from denial, a terrible fear that at least the first AIDS cases would be seen as responsible for their illness by using not just paupers, but, a lot of different recreational drugs very heavily. And if it's a virus that's responsible, well, then, of course, they're innocent. They couldn't help it. I mean, the virus is the villain in the thing. And the terrible fear that gay men had then, I don't think it's too surprising that most of them simply believed what they were told by the government and by the AIDS industry. And most people, frankly, are not too capable of independent critical thinking. I mean, that's simply, what would I say, a sad part of the human experience.
Could you explain to us what paupers were used for, how often they were used, and who was using them, and what were the outcomes in the scientific literature to show why you were attacking the use of paupers?
Well, paupers became popular, first of all, in the sadomasochist, or S&M, part of the gay community, which is a very small part of it. They were promoted by an industry, you know, aggressively, and at its height, you know, every single gay publication except the New York Native carried ads for paupers, which could add tens of thousands of dollars to their revenue. But what paupers are, the original paupers, amyl nitrite, were intended for emergency relief of angina pectoris, heart pain. So they would be used by elderly people, probably at the end of their life. And if the elderly people died, I mean, that's what happens when you get old. But paupers, when gay men used them, it would be primarily, well, they would make the orgasm seem to last longer than it did. And if they were engaged in anal intercourse, it would relax the sphincter muscle and deaden the sense of pain. So it would make it easier. At least that's the rationale there. The government was largely responsible. The CDC actually issued a thing saying that they found no relation between paupers and AIDS, which may be true in a way. Well, not really. But the implication which the government and all of the gay organizations had is that anal intercourse is the main way that gay men have sex. Well, that has never been true, not historically. We have evidence from Berlin in the late 19th century, from Kinsey, and from when gay men get together, there are various techniques they use, mutual masturbation, full body contact, oral sex. All of those are far more frequent than anal intercourse. But the government made it look as though anal intercourse were the only way that gay men had sex. And so the constant promotion of condoms, a condom mania, is really responsible from a vicious and a dishonest public health service. It, to me, actually exacerbated the AIDS illnesses.
And who in the gay community were primarily using this? It wasn't everyone in the gay community.
No, only a small minority were using. Well, no, actually, that's not true. Probably a large proportion of people of gay men were using them because they had been promoted so heavily in all of the gay publications. And for all of the gay publications to advertise paupers clearly sent the message that they were safe to use. And that it was the thing to do. If you wanted to be gay, then of course you used paupers.
What was the scientific literature showing that these paupers could do to a otherwise healthy person?
Well, Hank Wilson and I published a pamphlet, and eventually in 1986, a little book called Death Rush, Paupers, and AIDS. And the main part of the book consists simply of a listing of all of the medical articles showing the toxicities of paupers. And there were several dozen such articles. It was an annotated bibliography, you know, summarizing what they said. And it's quite devastating. I mean, paupers can kill in different ways. They cause two different types of life-threatening anemia. They are clearly carcinogenic. Everything... Well, at this point in time, for various reasons, there is only one tenable hypothesis for why gay men were, and perhaps still are, developing Kaposi sarcoma, which is an affliction of the blood vessels. They used to think it was a cancer, but it's not. And everything about paupers, the butyl, you know, the alkyl nitrites, the volatile nitrites, is totally consistent with their causing Kaposi sarcoma in gay men. The time, the carcinogenicity, the fact that paupers affect the blood vessels, all of it, you know, ties together very, very strongly.
Wasn't one of the 30-plus defining illnesses called AIDS, collectively called AIDS, Kaposi sarcoma? And wasn't that one, along with pneumocystis pneumonia, those were the one and two primary symptoms manifesting in the early days of the AIDS epidemic?
Well, they're now, you know, well over 30 so-called AIDS indicator diseases. But in the beginning, there were really two, Kaposi sarcoma and pneumocystis carini pneumonia, which is nothing new. You and I and everyone in the world probably has pneumocystis carini organism in our lungs, and it's totally harmless as long as we're in halfway decent health. But the as far as Kaposi sarcoma goes, the AIDS authorities are totally contradictory. They now know that HIV could not cause it. Kaposi sarcoma and pneumonia are not only different, but almost opposite types of illnesses. In other words, Kaposi sarcoma is not caused by immune deficiency, it's caused by an overactive immune system or associated with it. The two illnesses have absolutely nothing in common except that the Public Health Service decided to link them together because gay men were getting them. But Kaposi sarcoma, I've written an article which is online about a meeting held by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, NIDA, in Washington, where Robert Gallo and other AIDS authorities admitted that everything they had said before on Kaposi sarcoma was wrong, and that it definitely is not caused by HIV, and so on and so forth. A number of the articles, you know, you can get on the website by doing a search. In that one, you know, simply search for NIDA and AIDS and paupers, and you'll probably get it.
So let me put this in perspective. One part of the attack against you personally and other gay journalists was that your research, based upon peer-reviewed scientific independent journals, well accepted by the mainstream science, it was the amine nitrate, or the paupers, which could prolong the sensation of sex and was used in some of the fast-track heterosexuals and the swingers, but also in a subsection of the gay community and those that were the people who had anal intercourse, possibly unprotected, and were using amine nitrate, and that was causing destruction to their immune system, overstimulating the immune system, and was a known carcinogen. And therefore, your reason was that if gay men are getting sick, shouldn't we examine the lifestyle, not just the virus? Because as you said, if it was just a virus, then the lifestyle is insignificant. But we didn't see all gay men getting sick, and we didn't see all heterosexuals getting sick. But we saw in certain groups, based upon what they were doing, they were getting sicker than others. And the first two of these conditions were in part due to that lifestyle. And so if part of the political agenda, if part of the ideology was to say, no, we don't want any more attacks against gays and gay lifestyle because we've had decades of that, and especially under President Reagan, instead, let's just focus exclusively upon it being a virus. Therefore, your diet, your lifestyle, how long you sleep, whether you drink or smoke or do drugs, that's immaterial. It's just in the lifestyle. And you were saying, sorry, that's not the case. Let's look at the science. And so you were getting attacked, death threats, simply because you were telling the truth, not based upon specious or speculative reasoning, but based upon good science. And that was accepted by many in the gay community and many gay journalists, but was rejected by those who either A, chose of their own volition for no other reason than to reject it, or, as you have suggested, some of those people within the gay community were financially connected to the drug makers. They were connected at some level, either ideological, politically, or financially, to, in effect, say no to anyone who countered just the virus by itself. Is that a fair oversight?
Overview? That's a good summary. I'll add that Hank Wilson and I were both attacked as being gay traitors and as being homophobic because of criticizing poppers, which to me is utterly bizarre and irrational. But
both of you are gay activists, yet you were homophobic. I'm not sure I understand that.
Well, a homophobe would be, I don't like the word, a homophobia would be someone who has, anti-gay bigotry.
That I am aware of. But how could someone who was, how could someone who had spent their adult life promoting gay rights and marching and writing on behalf of gays, as you had and your partners had, how could you then be a self-hating gay person?
Well, exactly. Yeah.
Makes no sense to me. A very specious argument against you. Now, let's go from there. You were threatened. They tried to stop the publishers from publishing your work. Tell us about, at one point, the number one read and respected gay publication in America, if not the world, was the New York Native. And talk about the positions they took, some of the findings they uncovered, that the heterosexual community and heterosexual scientific community could have benefited from if they at least were open to have read the material and then did some additional research following up on their leads.
Well, I was the first journalist to interview Peter Duisberg, and it was a very, very long interview in the New York Native. And doctors, internists, young doctors all over the world were faxing copies of it back and forth. It became, viral. But, it made it quite clear that HIV, by its very nature, could not possibly cause AIDS. But since then, the New York Native published my articles on AZT, which is where I'm in the area of my expertise as a survey researcher and statistician. I showed that the research on AZT, the phase 2 trials published in the New England Journal of Medicine, were not only invalid, but in fact fraudulent. And I had a long struggle with the Food and Drug Administration to get copies of the relevant documents, but eventually I did get them. And it showed that the research was totally fraudulent, that cheating of all sorts took place, and that the FDA approved the drug anyway, that they accepted all of the dishonest, fraudulent research in order to approve the drug. And there's only one explanation for how this could happen, and that is total corruption. But the situation is quite horrible. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people were murdered by AZT, which is a poison with no benefits whatsoever regarding so-called AIDS or anything else. The most toxic drug ever prescribed for long-term use. And I've done an analysis which shows that virtually all of the so-called AIDS deaths occurred after AZT was approved for marketing. And in fact, the so-called AIDS diagnoses had already begun to decline rather sharply before AZT was approved. And then all of a sudden, the AIDS diagnoses and AIDS deaths shot upwards. So for all kinds of reasons, I think it's clear that ACT caused these deaths. ACT is poisonous in a lot of ways, but in every animal studied, including human beings, it causes severe anemia. Anemia is so severe that people could only be kept alive for a little bit by giving them blood transfusions. And this is, well, my friend Casper Schmidt referred to this as sadistic medicine, and it almost looks as though it was deliberately designed to kill gay men and other people, as well as making a fortune. At its height, the gross profits from AZT amounted to $4.5 billion per year, which is a lot of money, and it certainly can buy off a lot of people and so on and so forth.
I knew Casper Schmidt and interviewed him many times. I did not accept that it was intended to kill off gay men. The consequence of it being so toxic could have done that. In fact, I looked at all the statistics in all the different scientific publications, and you could see this line going straight up. The more people took AZT, and especially at the dosage, 1,600 milligrams or 400 milligrams four times a day. I remember people telling me they were awakened in the middle of the night to take their AZT, and the sicker they got, the more AZT they received. And it just didn't occur to a lot of persons, why don't you stop the AZT? There was a group that was working with a doctor in New York, a gay doctor, Stephen Chiesa. Did you know Dr. Chiesa?
Yes, I did know him. I disagreed with him on some things, like poppers, for example.
Okay. Well, Stephen questioned the idea that AZT should be given at a high dose, and that he said that he sees patients, he takes them off as AZT and starts rebuilding their immune system. And there's where I was called to come in and help, since he wasn't a nutritionist, and I did the nutritional protocols for over 1,200 persons diagnosed with AIDS. And when you got them cleaned up, when you changed the unhealthy parts of the lifestyle, the ammonitrate, the alcohol, antibiotics, taking antibiotics like they were candy, drinking, smoking, staying up late at night. In fact, I remember once giving a lecture at a gay group, and I said, "Do you know the consequences of regular sleep deprivation, of going to bed very late and waking up early, and what it does to the human body, even if you're young?" And I handed out this study from University of Colorado showing the sleep deprivation in and of itself, with nothing else, is able in a period of about 2 years to destroy your immune system and circadian rhythm disruption. And in any case, a lot of the people who I interviewed, once they got healthy, they became long-term survivors, never had a sick day after that, and no one wanted to pay attention to those who were long-term survivors living a healthy lifestyle versus those who were just doing the AZT. And I remember a fella came, I filmed him for a documentary, AIDS the Real Heroes. There were 40 people who were long-term survivors using natural therapies and discussing the therapy. And one of them was extremely poignant and said that he and his lover both were diagnosed with AIDS, and they both had unhealthy lifestyles that they would later recognize, but at the time they didn't. He said it was just fun, and it was liberating. And yeah, they would sometimes party 5, 10. He said there was one time where he had 22 different sexual partners in one night at some bathhouse. And he said he thought he was having a great time. And then after about 2 years, he said it took 2 years before the crash came. But when it came, it was substantial. Thrush, Kaposi sarcoma, pneumocystis carinii pneumonia. And his partner went the orthodox route. He decided to go a more natural route, and he got on Chinese herbs, and there was a fellow in the Chinese herbalist in Chinatown that was working with him and cleaned up his diet, started getting regular sleep. But his partner was taking AZT and got worse and worse and worse. And he said one morning he goes into the bathroom and his partner is bent over the toilet throwing up. And he said, stop the AZT. And he said, well, they told me to increase it. And he had doubled his dosage. Mm-hmm. And he said he couldn't get him to stop, and he was at 3,000 milligrams of AZT today. And he said he did everything he could to get his partner to stop, but he believed in the therapist, and also there were these activists in his support group who wouldn't allow anyone to come to a meeting if they talked about giving up the drugs and doing a healthy lifestyle. They said, oh, that's quackery, don't believe in this, it's the drugs, the drugs. And his partner died about 3 weeks later. And he became so angry. And I remember, and you can see it in the film, he said, I'm angry. I'm really angry that we were betrayed. And he said, we were all betrayed. We were betrayed by the leaders within our gay community. We were betrayed by our medical doctors. We were betrayed by the media. And he said, I won't forgive them for that. And I'm glad I had a chance to interview him, because I could only imagine the pain, no matter how empathetic. The empathy does not allow you to register the pain that someone is feeling at the loss of a loved one, and especially when it was needless. And I remember debating six physician scientists, or physicians and scientists, at New York University Medical School in a debate, and I was the only one who was against AZT. All of them were for AZT, but all the activists in the back of the room were for AZT and were yelling and screaming at me because somehow they thought I had two heads. I wasn't getting on board. And I said, look, I'm a scientist. I'm looking at the science. The science doesn't show me that AZT is the way to go. So tell us about AZT. Tell us more of what you found. Tell us the fraud of AZT. I know the fraud because one of the leading researchers on the AZT panel at a university in New York came to me with a ream of documents showing me that patients who died while taking AZT were excluded, how they would take the sugar pill and it was sweet. They would throw it away because they all wanted on AZT. So it was a completely unblinded study, and they fast-tracked it, and it was fraudulent. And yet that became the therapy, and it was so toxic as a chemotherapy for cancer, they wouldn't allow it to be used, yet they were giving it to these people. And any doctor today using 1,500 or 1,600 milligrams of AZT a day would lose their license to practice medicine. So tell us your story on this, please.
Okay, but before AZT, I think you gave a good summary on that. I had never thought about sleep deprivation before, but I think that certainly played a role in weakening people's health. But as far as sex goes, I think sex is a healthy activity as long as you don't get venereal diseases and be forced to take antibiotics. I know people during the 60s, 70s, and 80s who had a lot of sex, but they didn't take drugs and they lived a reasonably healthy lifestyle, and they're still here. The people I've known well who died, you know, some of them younger than I am, I could attribute their deaths mainly in one word, which would be cigarettes. In one case, also alcoholism. But the sex, you know, itself is not harmful. AZT, I wrote a book called AZT Poison by Prescription. And I want to mention that two of my books are now online as free PDF books. One is called, you know, Death Rush, Poppers and AIDS, and the other is AZT Poison by, the other one is Poison by Prescription, the AZT story. And you can find them on my website. Simply do a search for AIDS and my last name, Lauritsen, Lauritsen, or just do a search on AIDS Pagan Press, and you'll find the website right away. The other two books, The AIDS War, which is a huge book of about several dozen articles that I wrote for The Native and new ones, is still in print, and one called The AIDS Cult, which is the only book really ever published that went into all of the reasons gay men were getting sick, including very powerful psychological factors. And the AIDS cult and the AIDS war are still in print. They're sold by Amazon or directly from Pagan Press.
John, could you give us some highlights from the AIDS war and AZT?
Well, the highlights from AZT would be showing that it's a poison with no benefits and that it was approved in fraudulent research. That would be the main thing. The AIDS war covers an awful lot of ground, but it would include, you know, even before the so-called AIDS virus had a name, before it was called HIV, my first article, published in February 1985, had to refer to it like things HTLV or whatever it was. I'm not sure I even remember. But the names they had before it was discovered is a rather doubtful word, because there's good reason to believe that HIV doesn't exist as a true virus, a cell-free, independent virus. But that's another story. But in my 1985 article, I showed that the CDC arranged their statistics in a way that made it look as though sex was everything, and totally submerging the idea of drug abuse. But I showed that when you looked at the statistics in a reasonable way, it indicated that all of the early cases, and here we're now probably fewer than 200 people, were heavy drug abusers of one kind or another, and especially the gay men. These people were taking half a dozen different drugs simultaneously, and they were using them heavily. So it's not surprising they got sick. In fact, it would have been amazing if any of them had stayed healthy. The AIDS war, I go into one article, which you would like, on the AIDS organizations, and I indicate that almost all of them, I can't think of a nice way of saying it, made things worse, that they were, in many cases, criminal organizations feeding the AIDS catastrophe rather than trying to solve it. I have one on a meeting of lesbian and gay health professionals where I was shouted down when I tried to say even a few words against AZT, and where the entire purpose of the conference appeared to be to make it easier for people to get AZT. In other words, they wanted nurses and people other than doctors to be able to prescribe it, and they wanted more people to use it. The entire conference, I would say, was phony, and very likely organized by public relations firm of the of Big Pharma, the pharmaceutical companies. But the, I'm not sure what I was going to say.
Well, here's an interesting insight that people should know, and we don't. Why didn't the gay community leaders in the early days avoid honest discussion and debate about the politics and science of AIDS? Why couldn't they just have open, honest, reasonable discussions?
Well, they should have, but there were very powerful forces involved here. And as far as gay publications go, a combination of threats and bribery made them toe the line. And things like The Advocate, which was a leading gay magazine, still is, had a health expert, Nathan Fain. And he wrote article after article attacking Hank Wilson and me for criticizing paupers. He basically was a spokesman for the Orthodox AIDS position, and he himself died of AIDS. So in his case, I don't know how much of it was the fact that he was paid off, I assume he was, or that he was simply diluted. I have no way of knowing, but that was typical. And a scientist wrote into the Advocate indicating the research she had done, indicating the, a likely connection between paupers and AIDS. And the Advocate sent her back a letter saying they weren't interested. So here they were with tens of thousands of dollars of revenue from ads for paupers, and yet they wouldn't publish a simple letter from a scientist indicating the dangers of paupers.
Let me share a story before the end of the program. But before I do, how common was it for the pharmaceutical companies, including Burroughs Wellcome, to spread money around to the AIDS foundations or to different activists and gay activists or gay organizations to make sure their message of AZT being the drug or any of the other pharmaceuticals coming after that were the first choice of action rather than changing unhealthy behavior?
Well, it was very common indeed. Now, here we get into a problem area, because whatever money they funneled would be done in the most underground, discreet way possible. So, you know, we have no way of proving a lot of it, but even the contributions that we have record of, there were a lot of them. My article on gay organizations in my book, The AIDS War, goes into a lot of that. But the I read a fascinating book some time ago called Toxic Sludge is Good for You, and it's an expose of the public relations industry. And the public relations industries have played a large part in the AIDS story. You know, any number of them are hired by different drug manufacturers. So, according to the book, Toxic Sludge is Good for You, about 50% of the news articles in the newspaper are in fact phony. They were just made up by public relations firms. So, it's really hard to know what to believe these days. But certainly anything showing the benefits of a drug, one should be at best skeptical.
John, I want to finish our segment with a request that was made by two roommates, two partners, who had been patients of Dr. Chiesa, and they said, Gary, if you really want to know this small part of the gay community, come with us. So they took me down to some of the gay clubs, and I didn't know where they were. I didn't know what went on. But every night they would call and say, ready to go. And so I'd go down there, and I would interview people. And I would ask them about their lifestyle and what they were doing, and did they notice any difference? And most people did not notice there was a difference. And most people were smoking, drinking, and we're not talking about beer, but hard whiskey. Most had had multiple sexual transmitted diseases, and really serious to me was a lot of people had hepatitis several times in 1 year. Well, that alone can kill you. And it really plays havoc with your liver, and that's where your nutrients are metabolized, and that's where toxins are conjugated and broken down and taken out of the body. Most were taking antibiotics. In fact, in one of the clubs, I noticed people handing out penicillin as if that was the way they thought or were told you could prevent sexually transmitted disease. You just take penicillin, that would prevent the disease. Well, that doesn't work. It never has. And then on top of that, there was the amyl nitrate. In fact, there were a group of trucks across the street off near Christopher Street, and you could see all these lit cigarettes in there. And when you went to walk in that area, your feet would crunch under the amyl nitrates. There were so darn many of them, the paupers. So, and then at about 4 o'clock in the morning, when they were coming back uptown, I'd drive back up. And so I said, let's just look at this. You're getting home. You're getting a few hours sleep. before you go to work. They were both school teachers. You come home from school, you take a nap, you eat dinner, and then you go off, and then you're smoking, drinking, doing drugs, antibiotics, amyl nitrate, sleep deprived, and alcohol. All seven of those are immunodestructive. And yet for 2 years, they didn't see anything. But when the crash came, it came strong. Fortunately for them, they then said, okay, maybe it's time that we stop these activities and instead rebuilt their health. And I work with them. And then every day, 7 days a week, from 5 in the evening till midnight, for 9 years at the Tri-State Healing Center, I work with gays who had AIDS-defining illnesses because they wanted to all come together and have their own support system. And they were doing intravenous vitamin C and homeopathy and vegetarian diets and juices. In fact, we had a juicer there. A person was just making juices for everyone. They were taking things like bitter melon juice. And those people were 12 of them completely reversed all AIDS-defining illnesses and were HIV negative. They ended up on Tony Brown's Journal on PBS over a period of 5 years. And yet that was well known within some segments of the gay community. And yet there were others who were saying, don't do any of that. It doesn't matter. Well, to those who were alive today, it did matter and does. And I just wish that people understood that had we had these discussions, a lot of lives would have been saved. Final thought, John.
Well, you gave a, I think a point needs to be made that it was only a minority of gay men that lived that way. But those who did, it's, of course, you know, living that way, you cannot be healthy. But you reminded me I didn't put in a plug for my latest book, which is called A Freethinker in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's basically written by a loyal member of AA, but critical. In other words, I criticize the religiosity of AA, but on the other hand, it saved my life. And you mentioned that people can be very, very sick, but once they clean up their lifestyle, they can return to health if they do the right things. In my case, I was very, very close to death. This is a long time ago. It was 47 years since my last drink. And for a couple of months, I wasn't at all sure that I would survive even after I stopped drinking. But I did stop, and I did other things to get my health back together. And now I'm 76. I'm in, I would say, good health, except slightly overweight. I go to the gym, I swim in salt water in the summer, I sunbathe, and I do take supplements of different kinds. I won't go into them all. But I'm still here. And all of these years, you know, after I was so close to death. But anyway, my little book, A Freethinker in Alcoholics Anonymous, is starting to sell well. And it's the only book on the market that is both critical of AA and also defender of it. All other books are either on one side or the other.
John, you're also something else. You're not only alive and able to tell your story, but you're reaching people who never heard the other side of the story, those who challenged, the dissidents within the community, within the gay community, within the AIDS community, within the journalist community. And so you have that opportunity at this point in your life, and you've done an outstanding job today. Thank you very much. We look forward to another conversation. John Lawrenson. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour.